This is the Poe and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and Ellen Carter Woodbridge is here. She has a new book. It's going to be a debut book, and we're the lucky ones. So open us up, Ellen, with a poem.
This poem is called Suspect. She will tell you that a stranger entered her home, removed the pearl necklace from her dressing table, poured a glass of wine, and left. A different story each time, or 10 versions of the same. A stranger came and stole the only gift her mother gave her. A mother who lived in regret and gave her only one gift. And so the suspect came while she was sleeping. She was voiceless, and he left shame. We were in another room, and we heard nothing.
I'm so glad you started with that, because it is kind of characteristic of your style. We have something unusual happening, and a character's doing something mysterious, and then there's human consciousness that comes into the poem all around it. What is this new book about, and do you think we'll find poems like this in it?
Yes, I do. I think this poem is very, maybe evocative. I don't know if that's quite the right word, but this is the kind of poem that I often write.
I'm glad we started with it. And tell us about the new book. What's the title?
The book is called The Meaning of Life, and there is a title poem also called The Meaning of Life, and there's a sort of interesting story that goes behind that. I was taking a poetry workshop about 3 or 4 years ago, and the instructor said to all of us, really, how will you know that you're really a writer? When will you really believe in yourself as a writer?
Mm.
And so I thought about it, and I said, well, when I write a poem called The Meaning of Life, and it gets published. So I wrote the poem, and then I wrote the manuscript, and the book got published.
That was a good answer. When I get a book published under that title, now do you know the meaning of life now, Ellen?
Partly.
You're getting there. You're getting there. Okay, so let's have another.
Okay. This is called Garden. I choose the flowers to withstand the cold because I plant too early, always. I buy them before others can, afraid the most beautiful will be gone before I can secure them for my garden. But each spring I learn I was not wrong. In the collage of columbine, salvia, and winter rose, I meditate on the blossom, the solar light of my evening garden.
I'm going to ask you to read that one more time.
Garden. I choose the flowers to withstand the cold because I plant too early, always. I buy them before others can, afraid the most beautiful will be gone before I can secure them for my garden. But each spring I learn I was not wrong. In the collage of columbine, salvia, and winter rose, I meditate on the blossom, the solar light of my evening garden.
The reason I wanted everyone to hear that, it goes by too quickly, because it's a really interesting. It seems to be a straightforward account where you're just telling a mere story. But if you hear what's going on, you turn away from story. For example, why does the speaker plant too early? Over and over. And the last stanza, the speaker lands on her feet, but in spite of the victory, there's a sad tone. The sunlight on the evening garden.
Mm.
So that there's a layering under these simple words. And that is what you're known for. The most simple of all words. But underneath that is a veil. And we will continue to unpeel that with each poem. Do you agree that the poem has a lot going on in three stanzas?
I do, yes. I often start with just a simple description of something that I did or something that I thought, and then I sometimes surprise myself by learning what it was really about.
There we go. I can almost feel the discovery on the page mm-hmm. as it unfolds, mm-hmm. and that's your gift. And she was born in Washington, D.C., this Ellen Carter. Spent her early life in Japan and Germany, eventually in Baltimore, where she is well known. Graduated from Antioch College and Johns Hopkins University writing seminars. And she's big in the Baltimore, Washington writing community and has been beloved and supported for many years there. Her poems have appeared in Agni Review, which is really hot. That is one of the premier magazines in America. It's been going on since the 60s. DreamWorks, The Falcon, Mass Transit, Poetrees, The Washington Review, we could go on and on. She's worked as a learning specialist and a writing teacher and lives with her family in Maryland. And we're going to find out how poetry informs all that. And if you'll read another poem, then we'll continue to know.
The next poem is called She. It's spelled S-I-D-H-E. She is a Irish fairy or person of sort of imaginary creation.
I didn't know that.
She. They allow me to leave my trace on this earth, this promise of 12 months and then begin again. Feeling and sense is in the tree root. No bell rings, only the tissues of leaves count my days.
We have to hear it one more time.
She. They allow me to leave my trace on this earth, this promise of 12 months and then begin again. Feeling and sense is in the tree root. No bell rings, only the tissues of leaves count my days.
I really am interested in that one insertion, no bell rings. It is so unlike all the other images, earth, you know, all of these things, tissues, leaves, but then a bell. And so what I feel is that there will be no accounting, no measurement, but yet it continues.
Yes.
That's pretty, you know, if someone said what I just paraphrased and they say make a poem about it, it would be impossible. But to start with the idea and then to have it ramify, you can't start with the ramifications and make it into an idea.
Yeah. I think this poem may have started as an exercise. This is one of my more mysterious poems in that I'm not sure where it came from. But I think it may have started as an exercise.
A prompt, maybe?
A prompt, yeah, yeah.
But yet that the will is there to draw
from. Oh, yes, I totally agree.
Is the interesting
part. Oh, I totally agree, yes.
Yes, because you have the database, and you just need someone to light that match.
37 years.
And what was your specialty?
Well, I had several jobs there. I started off in the English department, and I was teaching freshman English. And then I had a couple of, in my first year there, I had a couple of basketball players in my class and got to know them very well and got to be very fond of them. And the coordinator of the academic support office got in touch with me and just, you know, as they checked in on students mid-semester, wanted to know how they were doing. And we just started talking and I got to know more about the department and more about the support for student athletes. And
oh, there's a department called Support for Student Athletes.
Academic support, yeah.
Every college has that?
Not, I think they do now, yeah. Mm. And ended up actually within about 2 years moving over to the Office of Academic Support and becoming an academic coordinator and a learning specialist.
Well, that meant that you worked with only athletes.
Only athletes. I also worked for Office of Disability Support Services for 7 years, and then briefly for the Dean of Students also. So I had several jobs there.
Well, I'm very interested in the way that you taught writing.
Sure.
And how did you teach writing?
In many different ways. I worked as, in my position as learning specialist, I tutored some courses directly. So I worked with students who are taking freshman English, or I worked with some of the English majors on their papers. And it was very individual. I really based it on what the particular student needed. Sometimes a student would come to me and just want help getting some ideas for a paper. So we would just kind of brainstorm. I had other students who really, really had trouble organizing their thoughts. They had anxiety about writing.
Would be a tough one.
Maybe they had, less experience coming out of high school with writing the longer papers, and they weren't sure how to start, you know, a 15-page paper. And so I tailored it very, very much individually. I don't think I did really anything the same with any of my students. And that's what kept the job so interesting. People often said to me, you were at GW for 37 years? You know, like, didn't you get bored? And no, I never got bored. I had different students every single semester. And my job, it was just...
Were they tutorials?
Well, I was an academic advisor, so I supervised some teams in terms of their academic progress. But mostly I was tutoring directly, one-on-one, or small groups, yeah.
Well, having gone to Johns Hopkins and having gone to Antioch and being fueled by poetry your whole life, reading and writing every day, then how do you think that gave you the heft to approach any subject or any problem that came to you? What do you think poetry did for you that an average writing teacher didn't have?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it gave me a really deep love of writing and a really deep connection. I've just always felt it was a very natural way to express myself. And I also love to draw and I also love to dance. But I think that writing is the thing that feels like my twin. It's the thing that is, I can't separate myself from it.
Well, then that gets to the real point of my probing, that you came with this as a person, that not every teacher of writing is going to do it the same way.
Right.
You came with something that you might have imparted to them, which is really a devotion to language.
And a love of language. And I think that for me, that was one of the most exciting things, was to see the students who thought they weren't very good writers realize they were wonderful writers. Two of my students from the first year, from my first semester, have published several books. And I just love that.
And so in a way, I like to think of that as holy work. When you get a person who is unformed and to let them know that they have self.
Yes, yes.
That it emanates from self.
Yes.
I can see why you stayed for 37 years, because that's just your cup of tea.
It is.
Well, let's have another poem.
This is called My Mother and the Other. One afternoon, as we sit in her living room playing with my children, she announces, "You are a better mother than I was." I look away, pick up a toy, smile as if I'm listening. If I agree, she will be hurt, and if I disagree, I will be wrong. I could tell her that despite her often declared love, she did not like the day-to-day of mothering. The other woman who took care of me as if I were her own lives on another continent. She had a quiet solitude, a gift she gave me, and a child's kimono sewn with red and orange flowers to wear at the street festival. At the end of her life, my mother slipped away. She no longer wanted to eat, but accepted sips of water. On the day we thought would be her last, my brother sang to her. I tried to hold her hand, but she pulled away. We heard her say impatiently to her sister, a twin already gone, "I am coming. I am coming." The other woman has been waiting, a promised trip home to Tokyo, a gift from my daughter, but the global pandemic delayed us. The other mother is ill now with a second stroke. When I was young, she spoke to me in her language, and I understood. So I have learned to write in hiragana. I will be there soon.
Wow, this is longer than your other poems, and it's different in composition. It's got people, places, things, which isn't just your method.
Yes.
Why is this the poem that you needed to write? It feels as if you needed to write it.
Yes, I think the impetus was the fact that I did go back to Japan in the summer of 2023. And it was a trip that my daughter and I had first tried to make in 2021. And 3 days before we were supposed to leave, everything shut down because of COVID. So we had to put the trip off for 2 years. And I think during that time period, I was thinking about what this trip meant to me.
But there's more than that in the poem. We have relationships in the poem. We have the very beginning of it, where there is an awkward relationship with your real mother.
Right.
And it begins very cleverly. What is the first stanza?
One afternoon, as we sit in her living room playing with my children, she announces, "You are a better mother than I was." I look away, pick up a toy, smile as if I am listening.
Right. And there we have it. There we have the tension set up. And so this poem, and what it does, is set up a triangle.
Mm-hmm.
And the tension, and in a triangle, there's always one man out.
Mm-hmm.
So that is where I find the interest in this poem.
Yeah.
And who is the one man out? Surely the nanny is not supposed to be the primary force of your life. Surely we have the mother trying her best to restore herself as the primary caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the recipient of these, which is the speaker mm-hmm. in the poem.
Mm-hmm.
So that even though I say it's a poem about person, places, and things, it's not.
Yeah.
It's about a triangle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I feel it had a necessary reason to be concluding the diverse loves that you experienced.
Yes, I was trying to find a kind of peace with it. I think we were pretty, I would think everybody was pretty open about it, that she was sort of my other mother.
Yeah. That's an interesting combination. And had you written about it before?
No, I wrote one poem about her a long, long time ago, but I've never written about
this. Is a good triangle.
I've never written about this complication.
Let's go on. Her name is Ellen Carter.
This poem is called Healing. Tree, the light leaves the earth, but you catch her fragments in your limbs. Light, single source of love, falls through the leaves. Once we knew you, the sun, the moon, but now no one sees. Love, rest here in the branches. We will collect the leaves, make a bed on the cold ground, and try again to find you.
Once more.
Healing. Tree, the light leaves the earth, but you catch her fragments in your limbs. Light, the single source of love, falls through the leaves. Once we knew you, the sun, the moon, but now no one sees. Love, rest here in the branches. We will collect the leaves, make a bed on the cold ground, and try again to find you.
As I read your poems and have known you as a writer over the years, I keep thinking, were you born with the understanding that language was the way you could make sense of the world? I mean, what do you think you came with that made you given to poetry? I know DNA, I think there's your family, you have poets in your family.
Yes.
But what were your child impressions that led you to this world, this secret, quiet, safe world of poetry?
Well, I always loved words. I remember from early on loving to read. I didn't have television in my life really until I was about 10 years old. And I think that was such a gift because I read all the time. I'd go to the library, take 5 books out, bring them home, and read most of them that night. And so I've always loved the magic of writing, where writing can take you, where stories can take you. And I just very early on felt so connected to what writing could do for a person. I wanted to be part of it.
And I believe that that answers the question of who becomes a writer and who does not.
Mm-hmm.
It is not just the words.
Mm-hmm.
It's the magic.
Yes, yes.
How do those hieroglyphics create a universe I can enter?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Are you glad?
Absolutely.
It's the only way we know, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, here we're going to go further and farther. And these are all poems found in The Meaning of Life, a book so fresh it crackles when you open it, and it is on every shelf now, and maybe Amazon, right?
Not Amazon yet, but you can order it through Uncollected Press in Baltimore, Maryland.
Uncollected Press. Okay, we'll say that again. And so here we're going on.
The seamstress walks along the shore. She knows age is made of sand, and her hand reaches out to breathe, to grieve. Resting in the shallows, her hand moves through the undertow. The agile sky is a piece of silk and looks for a reflection. She asks for breath, time to finish her dress, and draws the fabric from the sky.
I want to talk about the diction and the word choice here, because people don't understand how much goes into these simple, there's four little tercets, four stanzas of three lines each. But I just want to talk about the choices of words. She knows age, sand, hand. Listen to that repetition. Breathe, grieve. I think that when we read a poem, nobody stops to parse it, which is a good thing. But what keeps it aloft is the choice of words that ride on each other's backs. Okay, agile, silk. The agile sky is a piece of silk. And then she asks for breath, time, sky. I want you to read it again.
Okay. The seamstress walks along the shore. She knows age is made of sand, and her hand reaches out to breathe, to grieve. Resting in the shallows, her hand moves through the undertow. The agile sky is a piece of silk and looks for a reflection. She asks for breath, time to finish her dress, and draws the fabric from the sky.
Do you think that all came out because you have worked with words so many times? I mean, you didn't sit there and try to match those sounds.
Not initially, no.
But afterwards?
Afterwards. Again, I think this poem did begin as a prompt, and then I...
But it doesn't matter.
But it doesn't matter. But I don't... When I finished the poem, I knew what it was about, but I didn't know what it was about when I was writing it.
That is our secret to success, everybody.
Yeah.
That we aren't supposed to know the end game.
Yeah.
Or else it doesn't work. Or else it's manufactured.
Exactly. You have to trust that it's going somewhere.
Now, every one of your poems is so careful, and each word is like a pearl on a string. What is the risk of excess for you? What is there to worry about? I mean, why not be excessive?
Well, I do try to write longer poems, but I have a very hard time. I would say most of my poems are, you know, between 3 and 7 stanzas. They fit on a page.
It's your energy. It's your breath control.
Yeah.
I mean, so you breathe rather than bellow. It's interesting because what if you're sloppy?
Well, my rough drafts are sloppy. The poem that emerges in the end is about half of what I started with.
What is there to fear?
That it won't be clear, maybe, that the meaning will be lost.
That's a good one. That's a good one. We'll go on and we'll judge you on the next poem.
Okay. This is called Passing. We let the tree lie where it fell, and it became a bridge between this world, our home, and the world unseen. We disappear into the trees, deer leap ahead of us, bringing us to a clearing where we wait in twilight. We wait as children do on the unbroken path. What we lost yesterday, we find today.
That's lovely.
Thank you.
And now a final poem.
This is called Sanctuary, and this is the last poem in the book. The day begins with an orange sky, my canoe gliding through the water, the old year passing away. Along the bank, liatris blooms all summer. I disembark, looking for a place to sleep and build a fire. a shelter not from the world, but in it.
Ellen Carter, this whole time with you has been a shelter for us and is really the opposite of everything else in the world. Thank you. The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Funding is provided by the Sinipit Fund, the Rivada Foundation, Avi Deshashani, Yung Ki Kim Renault, Natalie Canivore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Sandy Kinlock. I'm Grace Cavalieri.